Alrighty, and today we have Karim, one of the co-founders of Ramp. So thank you so much for joining us. If you want to give a quick introduction on yourself, we're really excited to have you with us today.
Sure, thanks for having me, Julian. Yeah, sure. As you just mentioned, I'm the co-founder of Ramp, but before that, I had started another company called Paribus with one of the same co-founders, Eric Glyman. And prior to that, I was actually a software engineer who had almost by accident got into management consulting post the 2008 financial crisis. So a lot of my early work in consulting actually was helping banks understand risks better, manage their capital. And a lot of that early experience, I guess, came back to being useful when we started Ramp in 2019. And since starting Ramp in 2019, we've I guess grown it to about so we're about 500 people now, serve upwards of 15,000 companies. Yeah, so for those of you who don't know Ramp or haven't heard of Ramp, we're a finance automation platform providing everything from a corporate card to reimbursements to bill pay for growing companies and finance teams who are looking to like modernize their operations.
Amazing. And so maybe going back to the early days of Ramp, what kind of spurred the idea initially? And did you and Eric, I guess, how did you guys decide to work together? And did you always think you'd start a fintech company?
Yeah, of course. Maybe we have to go back in time a little bit for this one. So Eric and I in 2014, we're both in New York. We're both working, I guess, typical corporate jobs. He was in restructuring. I was in consulting, and both of us were yearning for something more. Wanted to do something more challenging, more interesting. Frankly, that we control and could have a bigger impact on. I mean, in consulting, it just felt like you'd move from project to project without really seeing the impact. And in restructuring, I don't want to speak too much for Eric, but I think for him, it felt like you're just waiting for a catastrophe for things to happen, but there's not much you can control. A lot of the like great restructuring work really gets done when things are bad, but it's not really something you can predict. And like as we were talking through ideas, I guess kind of like both came like slowly to that like first company idea together, where we were buying lots of things online and traveling, and then noticed that the prices of the items we were buying were fluctuating all the time. And around the same time, the Amazons and Walmarts of the world were hiring armies of data scientists to try and maximize every single the dollars they could make from every single transaction, and like the prices were fluctuating all the time. And that paired with the fact that they all had best price guarantees that they would market and talk about and get billboards. And so we essentially started our first company, Paribus, to help consumers save on their online purchases. So we would track all the purchases they were making online. And whenever the price of something dropped, we would reach out to stores on their behalf to get them a refund. And that was before all the AI and LLM craze. So a lot of what we had to build to communicate with stores, I guess, respond on behalf of customers to stores and get them a refund was a lot more challenging, I guess, than it would be today. And our primary focus, as I'm mentioning, like was savings, like understand data, take advantage of the big corpus of information that we were scraping, and then use it to help consumers win in a marketplace where it felt like the odds were stacked against them. So that company in 2016, we ended up selling to Capital One. And at Capital One, first, we learned something very interesting through the acquisition process, which was like, why would Capital One, a bank, want anything to do with a sort of like consumer shopping platform? And we quickly realized through the conversations that, card companies were really struggling to compete beyond just their marketing and their points and their rewards. And were looking for something that would give them an edge or help them differentiate in this very crowded marketplace. And Paribus was that. It was a way for Capital One cardholders to really get something out of the product, something more than just points and rewards and and marketing promises. And it was great. So we had a great experience at Capital One, scaled the user base another 10x. I believe that today Capital One Shopping, which is the new name of the group, reaches like upwards of 20 million customers, would be my guess. But through that process, more importantly, Eric and I like understood the nuts and bolts of fintech and financial services broadly, but specifically how card programs work, how interchange works, how fraud works, how credit works. And it's just like a fascinating business model in general. Like it's a free product, or for most places, it's sort of like a product that pays you and gives you points. And really, the merchants are paying for what it takes to like run the business in the background, and you're able to offer something relatively quickly to your customers at no cost to them. And that's something that kind of like stuck with us. Like, this is an interesting business model, but it kind of sucks, frankly, that like all the revenue was put into like points and rewards and things that have like become undifferentiated and very focused on sort of like the marketing difference, but very little on the product. So 2 years later, when we left Capital One, so that was sort of like mid-2018, we started thinking through, I guess, what we should do next. And there were like a couple things running through our heads. One was we should probably do something that no one else can, or that is harder to do for first-time founders, just because like we have a competitive advantage there. What should that be? We understand financial services. We are sort of super passionate about like using data to help people save money, save time, and be more efficient. And then we kind of stuck with this idea of like, wait, what if there was a better way to build a card program where from the ground up, where we'd focus most of our efforts not on the points and the rewards and those I guess things that were played and replayed time and time again, but instead try to differentiate on the quality of the product and the software. And around the same time, we were reconnecting with a lot of our entrepreneur friends who either were starting companies, joining early stage companies that we had met through sort of like Y Combinator in 2015, like, and asking them like, what would you want from a card? Like, what are the main problems you're facing? And time again, we would hear that, yeah, like I just want more money in my bank account and I don't want to waste money. It's like, oh, how are you wasting money? It's like, well, I don't know, like we're using like Linear and Asana and all these other like task management tools, and we use six of them, and I don't know why we're paying for six. Or we're using whatever, like there were a lot like overlapping product and their suite of tools, and then we get to a point where like they had no idea what they were spending on. And that's when things kind of clicked. It's like, okay, great. So it's going to be a card, but we're going to focus most of our efforts on helping companies save money, reduce waste, not spend for the same software six times, keep track of the things they're spending on better, not have to waste time on submitting receipts. And that's yeah, and that's how the idea for Ramp started.
Amazing. And so maybe going back to the Paribus days, I guess, as you, what was that acquisition process like? And I guess, how did you think about actually taking the acquisition versus, because I think most founders' dreams, especially with high ambition, is to really take it to that IPO stage. And so what was that like? And how did you and Eric kind of think about that?
Yeah, of course. So it wasn't something we had planned, candidly. I think around that time we were looking to raise Series A round. Things were going quite well, but yeah, I mean, we were discussing. We initially it was a partnership discussion with Capital One, and around the same time we started facing like real difficulties because like some of the big retailers were essentially trying to shut us down. They were trying to shut us down with through like technology and operations, but that was something that we just kept getting around. Frankly, like that wasn't the hard part, but also through legal means. And it was just very clear that they didn't want us there. And we knew that it was just so crucial to our long-term success to actually figure out a way to work with the retailers and in some cases build partnerships. And as we were discussing things with Capital One, like that was sort of the crux of the initial partnership. It's like, well, Capital One work with a lot of retailers. We have deals with them, understandings with them, good relationships with them. We can help you maximize your odds of success. And as the discussions with Capital One evolved, they got more and more excited about the like the potential of fully owning the business, and we were and we sort of had like two options to consider. Hey, do we raise funding here, or do we go through a debt acquisition? And we liked both options, but just like given the speed at which the conversations were happening, and like we had only been working on Paribus for something like a year and a half, and the offer that Capital One made was like massively life changing, not just for like Eric and I, but for like all of our like small team as well. Like we were only like 15 or 16 people, so it was just like very hard to say no to. Like rationally, it made a lot of sense. We would also get to like keep working on our product, scale the team, work relatively independently, which I don't know. It just it was yeah. There's definitely an element of like it was too good to be true, and it just like we're yeah. We love taking risks, obviously. Like we're entrepreneurs, but at the same time, like there's a point at which like it just makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely. Did you know immediately upon maybe, I don't know if there was a point in time, like closing of acquisition or something, that you guys were like, okay, at some point we're going to start something again, and like we're going to reach that pinnacle at some point, like we still want to reach that? Or was it kind of like, if it comes to us?
No, honestly, I think it was like the opposite at the time. Like some friends asked me, is like, "Oh, would you start something again?" It was like, "Hell no, absolutely not. This was hell." Yeah, it was like there was an element of realization around that time of like, "Oh wow, I'm glad we sold." Like it was getting really exhausting. And specifically, like, look, there are like so like the challenges that every startup faces, but there's something specific about Paribus that was extremely complicated, which was most of the infrastructure and the tech that we were building. We were building on top of sort of like a foundation that kept changing and didn't want us there. It's like you're building tech to like scrape receipts and product pages, and they're constantly changing, and they don't want you there, and they're constantly putting like blockers in place to prevent you from scraping things, and it was painful. I mean, it was right around that time. I don't know if you remember that, like Amazon stopped sending receipts via email. Like Amazon used to send like detailed receipts via email, and at one point it just stopped, and instead just put a button. It was like, if you want to see your receipt, go log into Amazon, and that kind of stuff was happening to us like every 2 weeks. Yeah, so it was painful.
God, no, absolutely. And so, kind of transitioning to then starting Ramp, especially in the early days, I always think about Ramp as kind of like the East Coast Brex, and sort of like this rivalry between the two of you, and especially in the early days. And so, I guess, how did you guys think about it? And was that ever a thought in your mind? Or maybe that's just a little bit of my New York bias.
Yeah, I mean, there's so like yes or no. So I think in our minds it was more of like, look, like Brex seems to have taken the approach of we're gonna play the same playbook and do like points rewards and try to be like the modern bank slash modern Amex, and we from the very beginning had the perspective of like we don't think that's the right way to solve problems here. And instead, like our focus was like we want to build a software company that just happens to have a card and different things. But like our primary focus was like we want to win because of the quality of the tools and product that we're building. So for us, like that was maybe like the stronger differentiation. But certainly, like on from a like talent perspective, like we were New Yorkers through and through, and like from the beginning wanted to build like a huge talent hub in New York. Like I remember like the day that we recruited Nick Koblov, who's now our VP of engineering and used to be a VP of engineering at a firm and had moved from the West Coast to the East Coast. Like my first couple of conversations with him were all around like I want to build like the biggest pool of like talented engineers, but talented people more broadly in New York. I want New York. Like I want to build the best tech company in New York. There are a lot of them in California. Not enough of them in New York, although there was sort of like an older generation of companies in New York, which are like the Etsy's and the MongoDB's, et cetera. But it just felt like New York should be where fintech happens. And yeah, we can get into like the whys, but I think there are a lot of elements that today I think have sort of like proved us right on this, like the ability to hire certain types of people in New York that can help your company be successful just doesn't exist in Silicon Valley for fintech in particular.
And maybe on that hiring, like, what was it like sort of convincing some of those first key hires? And given you did have that mindset of like really wanting to be in New York, and I mean, I think by 2019, the New York tech ecosystem had definitely grown quite a bit, but obviously COVID accelerated that even further. But like, was there ever that challenge of convincing people to come from SF, or were people kind of bought in immediately?
No, it was, look, I mean, the big like preface here is it's a lot easier being a second time founder. Honestly, like the like even the most sort of like risk taking engineers, entrepreneurs, people who want to join startups have some level of risk aversion. And when someone's trying to recruit you for their like next billion-dollar idea or crazy company, you always have to like have a little bit of paranoia. It's like, okay, there like are a gazillion people trying this all the time. Like, why will this one succeed? So if you know the person and if you've worked with them before and if you already have a track record, it helps. So a lot of our focus was like, who are the absolute like best people in our very small network? And two of our first three hires were people who had interned with us 4 years ago as freshmen in college. And 4 years later, as we're starting our second company, we've convinced to join us. And I think both of them had offers that they basically rescinded. So it was hard to convince them in the sense that they already had like in their mind this idea of like, oh, I'm going to go join Citadel. I'm going to go join this tech company. And like we had to convince them to just like not like follow through on their offers. And then like there are a couple of ways we did this. I think the personal relationship is probably what was like most at play here. But really, when you think about early stage startups in particular, like there is an asymmetric bet there. Like there's a lot of high upside, very little downside. Like you join, like if you're someone who's capable of getting a high paying offer, or whatever, at a Citadel or a Facebook or a Google or any of the large like tech or finance companies. Like if they were willing to hire you this year, they're definitely going to be willing to hire you next year, arguably with like a better role and salary if you did something meaningful, no matter what it was. Like they know you, they already decided they wanted to hire you, like they're going to want to hire you next year. So you join this company with sort of like high upside, lowish valuation. And within a year, most companies, you kind of know if it's working or not. So if it works, great. Like you stay on, you got there early, you got equity that has become a lot more valuable. And if it doesn't work, you can always go back to that like same job you were going to go to anyway. And like that is still true to this day. Like that's why I just think that like people often mistake like joining a startup for like, hey, this is something that's very risky and uncertain. Where in reality, like if you're someone who's too like capable of having that like high paying, less risky job in the first place, you're going to be capable of getting it very quickly in a year anyway. So yeah, like a lot of that framework was like certainly like very helpful in the early days to try and like attract the people who are probably like less risk averse than usual. We banked a lot on referrals, and to this day do. I think they're very valuable. So, yeah.
And so as you think about the growth of Ramp, I mean, from the outside, it just grew like that classic sort of hockey stick straight up to the right, maybe even faster than that. And so from your perspective, was there ever a time when you were like, this might not work, or this might fail? And like, what was that look like? And then maybe on the flip side, like, what was that time when all of a sudden you were like, oh, this is working, and like we are like, this is going to be a big company.
So the short answer is always like I'm still very paranoid. I mean, maybe that's good, maybe that's bad. I don't know. It's certainly not great for my health sometimes, but I think it helps to be focused on like the things. I mean, the kind of engineer I am is like always looking for the things that are like suboptimal and kind of broken, and trying to fix them. And part of the analogy, like I sort of had in the early days, is it's a little bit like playing a set of like poker tournaments, where you like you have some chips, you win the sort of like beginner tournament, and then you raise more money and you get more chips. But it's still the same game you're playing at higher stakes with like tougher opponents. And if to like you lose on the second tournament, like you still kind of lose. So I don't think there was ever a moment where we're like, hey, like it's done. Really, what has shifted over time is the time horizon through which we make decisions. Like in the early days, you're like, well, I don't really care about this thing being important in 3 months or 6 months. Like we might not exist in 1 month, so how do we like get this out as fast as possible? And like over time, as you sort of like raise more funding, get more certainty, get more paying customers, get more revenue, you start to think in the horizon of like 2, 3, 4, 5 years. So some of that has shifted. But if I were to go back to like, I guess like one moment that was very crucial, I mean, like for many of us over the past couple of years, it was like COVID. It hit everyone at the same time. And there's kind of like this double whammy for us in a way where it's hitting us as a company. Like we're affected. We can't go to the office. We can't work together. There are all these things that like every company was hit by. But we're also affected because all of our customers are affected. If they're unable to operate, like it's like we're unable to like raise debt, they default on their payments, and we're kind of like in a pickle. Now, part of it was also like we were a little bit lucky in that like we launched right around then. Like we didn't have that many customers. And as a result, it just meant that like we could manually go through like every single one of our customers, reach out to them, talk to them, and build a lot of our risk processes from scratch around that time. So we were able to like from the ground up, like build the right like underwriting processes, fraud processes, because there was a lot of fraud around that time. But it was scary. Like we would meet like every day for 2 hours with our head of engineering, different people in risk and underwriting, really some people from around the companies that just wanted to help and go through every single customers one by one and go through their like balance sheet. And we had sort of like a COVID risk framework. It's like, how bad is it if like COVID gets worse? How bad is it? Like, how badly is this particular customer affected based on the industry that they're in? And we certainly did not know what we were doing. We tried to reach out to, well, we didn't know perfectly what we were doing, but like, I don't think anyone did. Like we reached out to like friends at the risk departments of like more larger companies with more experience at consulting firms. Like, oh, like what's your COVID framework? And everyone was kind of figuring out on, like what they should do on the go. So it was both very stressful and also a lot of fun at the same time, to be honest. It was like a time where like the bonds in the company like got stronger, and a lot of like great relationships were built. And to this day, like there's a very so, like strong relationship between our customer operations, risk, and like engineering team, and the members who like during the early like periods of ramp were like to like working hand in hand to like solve some of the COVID challenges.
Absolutely. And I have assumed that the last 2 years, I mean, not that Ramp has been along that much longer than that, but like the last 2 years has also been provided a lot of ups and downs in terms of obviously COVID and then into sort of this kind of like tech boom and then a lot more softening within the tech market and then even like most recently SVB. And so how have you kind of dealt with those ups and downs, especially from your guys' side?
I mean, SVB was one. I think there was a also like a time period where like a lot of the crypto companies were struggling around the same time as well. Those things happen every 2 to 3 months. And look, by now we have like a better sort of like incident response playbook and a way for us to sort of like get together, plan out the response, and act on it. But honestly, like the best answer that I have for you is probably a very high sense of urgency and ownership from across the company. Like I'm thinking through some of the like SVB crisis still fresh in my head, but like people from across the company jumped to sort of like participate in the customer ops response as well. The risk team was helped by teams across the company. Like the sales team like went on the offensive in some ways and like tried to like help customers that we had like or prospects that we had chatted with, we knew were on SVB, we knew couldn't move because of SVB, but were actually like very interested in moving to Ramp. So it was very like refreshing to see the company like get together. It's definitely become a much more organized process than it was 2 years ago. The roles are clearer, the playbooks are clearer, the systems are better and more robust. But I'd say like the biggest thing that we've done to make that easier over time is invested a lot more in our internal tooling and processes. Like it's something that like today is it's very clear that we care a lot about it. It wasn't 2 years ago, but we now have like like an extremely talented like product and engineering team specifically working on those internal tools.
Is there a role that was the hardest or you felt the most crucial for you to hire for?
I think risk roles broadly tend to be like that for a couple of reasons. I think one of the mistakes that a lot of fintechs make is they assume that like risk is just a data problem, which in the long term it is. But you need to have like a full economic cycle or more or enough data for it to be a data problem. But as a startup, you don't have that. So you really want some experience and expertise. Like you don't want that like one meteor on year one to just like completely change the trajectory of your company. So you really would benefit from some risk experience and the right level of doubt. The other problem is like most of these experienced folks, yeah, like have like there aren't that many of them. They work at companies that really utilize the talent because they have the amount and level of data. They tend to be more risk averse, frankly. There aren't a lot of them that either are at startups or are willing to join startups. So it's kind of hard to like find the right combo of someone who's growth oriented, not super risk averse, but is a risk expert. So like filling some of the risk roles was crucial and challenging, like just like getting the exact right person for sure. I think legal, interestingly, is also like one of those. Like finding like great talented lawyers who would be a good fit for a startup is kind of funny. Like we joke with I have a very close relationship and love our general counsel, but I joke around with him that he would make a terrible lawyer because he speaks so fast. So he wouldn't be able to like charge his clients enough if he were at a law firm. But at a startup, it works great. Like the tempo is there, the speed is there, and I think the ability to like work fast, speak fast, and resolve all the problems quickly has been great. And especially in fintech, like you want folks who are to like willing to like actually go read the text and make their own opinion as opposed to like rely on like six modeled versions of like experts who've interpreted the thing wrong. Like there's still so many opportunity in like going like reading the letter of the text and seeing what it says as opposed to like relying on someone who tells you like, oh, like you can only do like whatever, KYC, KYB this way. And it's like, well, like if you read the text and just do what the text does, like here's a way that you can do it better. So yeah.
Absolutely. And so how has your role as like founder and CTO evolved since the start of the company to now?
A lot. I think a lot of what I gravitate towards is as I mentioned earlier is like if you look at this like our company as this like massive machine, like which cogs are like most broken or like the biggest bottlenecks, and how can I me plus maybe rally a few people to like fix those, and how do we keep doing that constantly? So as a result, I think the area that I focused on has changed and evolved over time. Like I think in the early days, it's kind of like a lot of sort of like engineering, architecture, and product work. But now it's kind of like a lot of the same skill set applied to the company. It's like where do we need to hire more? Where do we need to focus on like our recruiting pipeline more? Where do we have How do we sort of like reinvigorate and update our like performance management in certain cases? How do we make sure that we're consistent in the way we're measuring data between sort of like engineering, marketing, and sales if we're looking at these same numbers? So yeah, like I think building up our data team and sort of like how the data team works with the rest of the company was a focus of last year. I think one of the newest focuses, which I guess shouldn't surprise you, is like how do we best use some of the latest advancements in AI to like both make our company better and also make our product better for our customers. And there are a lot of projects going on right now, and I'm just like very excited for the future of that.
That's great. Do you miss being in the weeds more?
Yeah, yes and no. I think I still get in the weeds very much of like different areas. I'm just not in the weeds as much of like the code base. I think it would just be terrible to have me there because any dependency on me given the amount of context switching would slow everybody down. And I think by now there are like far like better folks on different parts the product and engineering team that I just like trust fully and love working with.
How close to the initial vision that you and Eric had for RAMP is it today?
Extremely close, frankly, and that still surprises me to this day. It's like I think with this company more than Parabris. So with RAMP, we certainly sort of followed say like the Keith playbook, and maybe that's part of the reason that Keith Raboy was excited to invest in the early days. I think his view of startups are probably more akin to making a movie, where you have like a very clear so like script and vision for the movie in your head, and then you raise some funding and like you go and shoot the whole movie. You don't just like shoot a scene and then like try to guess what the next scene should be like and iterate, like you would make for a terrible movie. And the way to do this for RAMP is really by keeping like the vision and mission so like broad enough that it can support all the things that we plan to do. Like at the core of it, like we were never like even when we started this, like we were never like just a card company. The plan was like how do we build software to make like finance operations more efficient and save the company time and money, and how do we do that with software? And card was one way to do that, but there's so many different ways, and a lot of the products we're building today, like some you could argue like are not like fintech at all. Like these are like standalone products that like regular or whatever standalone tech companies can be building, whether it's on like procurement or travel or negotiations or any of these other things that we're building.
So, what has surprised you most about like this founder journey versus the Paribas one?
I guess I shouldn't have been surprised by this because you hear it over and over again. But like, there's certainly an element with RAMP is like when it works really quickly that you feel and you see, and you hear that from a lot of companies and see it in the journey of like companies that have been like very successful. Like you know when you have product market fit, and there's certainly like an element of that that we felt once with RAMP, but like we also felt with subsequent product launches. And some of the products like not don't see the same success as others, but like when it's working, you see it working very quickly, and you know that yeah, that sounds a little bit cliche. I mean, the other one, which is also cliche, unfortunately, is just the importance of like hiring, well, hiring in general, but like hiring extremely talented people and just hiring slowly and focusing on the right types of folks really makes a difference.
How did you stay true to that over the last year or so, just as so many founders, so many companies were growing so quickly, needing to hire talent much quickly that a lot of them probably, whether it was on purpose, lowered their bar. And so how did you make sure that you guys were staying true to that?
By not focusing on sort of like the outcome and the number of people as a metric at all, ever. So we never, I mean, I sort of like refused to participate in any form of like proper headcount planning for engineering in particular. It's always been like, hey, I could try to predict how many people we're going to have, but I don't want to like put a plan on paper and be like, great, like this is the number of people that we need to hire and hit. And that's always been like, and there's always been an understanding there with our talent team, our engineering team, that like the constraint is the bar. It's not the number of people. And we want to try to hire as many people as we can who meet the bar, right? And the as we can ends up being constrained by either the bar, like, hey, we can't find people who meet the bar, or the like interviewing and sourcing capacity, or like mentorship and so like ability to like train and manage that person. And the constraints like tend to shift. And whenever it's like, oh, we don't have enough mentors, then I work on that. Or when it's, we don't have enough recruiters or interviewers, like I work on that and fix it. But most of the time it just goes back to the bar. And as long as the constraint is the bar, like I will never just go out and say like, hey, we should just like have a headcount number and hire more people. So we just haven't, like we didn't hire that many. And like, look, you could see it in our numbers compared to like some companies of sort of like comparable like revenue or like market cap metrics or however you want to cut it. Like we have fewer engineers, even though we're like so like very proudly engineering led company. Like like engineering is often so like ahead of the rest of the company on like the things we're building and what we're pushing forward on. And we're very proud of that. Like we take a lot of pride in like the efficiency of the team as well.
And then maybe just two more questions. I think one, going back to Brex, but also maybe broadly on competition, how have you kind of blocked out the noise, or have you guys not? How do you guys deal with competition internally? And is it something that you openly talk about, think about, or is it something where it's like, you know what, we're just kind of going to execute and run our own race?
Yeah, I think it's good to be aware of the competition. But I mean, I think like probably Bezos says, like, we want to obsess about our customers. And if you look at the market and the customers and what we're hearing from them, like, most of them still don't really use any of the like new age corporate card solutions and are still stuck with a combination of like Amex and like Excel spreadsheets. And frankly, like, most businesses are like using checks where they should be using cards or ACH. So like, the opportunity is so massive. And I think sometimes it can be like a waste of time to sort of like focus and obsess on the competition. Where I think it's interesting to see where the competition's at is like, so like around serving this very niche segment of like, so like tech startups and other founders and startups. Like, yes, for sure, like in that segment, like, we run into like, to like newer competitors a lot, because like these companies tend to be aware of like the newest tools and are looking for any competitive advantage they can get through like their vendors or the things that the tech stack that they use. And we very happily support these companies, and specifically the ones that like tend to have like higher ambitions and want to grow. Like, we've never been sort of like the company to focus on like the rewards and perks and like the coolness of being like an early stage founder. Like, if you're doing it for the likes and the follow and the coolness, like, we're not the right company for you. Like, we've always been like a lot more focused on like efficiency, scale, growth. And like, once you get to the point where like, hey, like, I want to run like a serious finance operation here, we think we do a pretty good job of like serving you with the tools you need to do so, and to like help your company save as much money and time as possible. So just broadly, I think like different competitors are focused on different sub segments of customers and different ways of serving them. And like, we want to be focused on sort of like the ones who care about, so like, efficiency and performance. And that is also, I think, reflected on our like internal culture as well. Like, we have a pretty like competitive culture and internally, and just people are very like proud of being very like fast and efficient. And
amazing. And then if you weren't doing this, like, what would you be working on?
That's a good question. I mean, that answer changes probably all the time. I mean, I think there's like a massive amount of opportunity with the newer advancements in AI. So I don't want to be sitting there and be like, hey, what could I be doing if I weren't be doing this? And instead, I want to try to do like some of these things within Ramp, and like, we have a lot of things coming on that front. But yeah, like, I mean, it's funny, like, I've been playing, I'm about to like apply for Swiss citizenship. So my wife is Swiss, and we've been like thinking about it for some time. And like, one of the things I've been toying with is essentially like training ChatGPT to help me prepare for the exam. And I think it's pretty good at that. So it's, so like, I've been toying with like, hey, how can you use essentially like AI to teach yourself like new skills and new things? And that's been pretty good. I've always thought there's also, I mean, just like random ideas out there, but like an untapped opportunity in assessing people's skill set and talent based on like video games. I think a lot of video games are very different. And so like the skills that it takes to be good at them, but video games, like, just strategy, like board games more generally, and people love them. But I think there's something interesting in like being able to tell who's going to be good at what in a company setting based on the games that they're good at. Like a first person shooter player might be good at making decisions under uncertainty. Like a chess player might be really good at whatever, like broad strategy and like visualizing outcomes. A soccer player might be like, I don't know, very competitive and relentless and good at teamwork. And like, there's some of these things that like we sort of like inherently know, and like some people loosely take into account in the recruiting process, but there isn't sort of like a good system to like map people's sort of like other skill sets to like what they would be good at in a company setting. So I think that's another area that I've been like thinking about for years now. Like, I don't think there's like a good enough company focused on this.
Fascinating. So you're not necessarily tied to fintech then?
No. I mean, yeah, No, all the fintech things we're going to be doing at Ramp. I think.
There you go. I like that. Consolidated into Ramp. Well, perfect. Thank you so much for taking the time to chatting. I really appreciate this and for your candor as well about your journey before Ramp, as well as the journey throughout the life of Ramp so far.
Thank you, Joy. Hope this was fun, and yeah, thanks for this fun chat.